By the way, I know you're covering the Lipscomb game tonight, and this is one of those things. Back when I worked in college athletics, you know, you would get this time of year, you would start seeing some love for the mid-majors that are out there. And this year, it seems like even more so. And although people nationwide want to overlook an Austin Peay team, for example, they're tied with Belmont, along with Murray State, as far as in the OVC, atop the conference standings. But there seems to be a lot of extra love this year for the mid-majors, and it may be one of those things where they're teasing them, thinking about the fact that leagues that usually get just one team advancing to the big dance, they're kind of like, you know, throwing that carrot out there that, hey, the potential is certainly there for multiple teams in some of these leagues. Until they do it again, that's when I'll believe it, because the OVC, I think you have to go back always to the 80s, the last time something like that happened.
Right, and I think that's the same case in the OVC this year. I mean, you got four teams, really, that are, you know, right there at the top, and all of them, I think, are good enough, including Belmont, Murray State, and then you have Austin Peay and Jacksonville State. Whoever wins that league is going, and that's it. However, now I want to ruin my column when I'm writing off this Lipscomb game, but I believe, actually, that the Atlantic Sun has a chance to be a two-bid league. And, again, it takes an unusual set of circumstances. One of the things it takes is for there to be a bad bubble, and this year is a terrible bubble. And by that I mean, you know, if you look at the pool of at-large teams around the cut line, it's weak. And so weak that if you look at bracketologists right now, most of them have Lipscomb as a 10, some as an 11. A 10 is above the line of even the last at-large, you know, power league teams to get in.
Right.
And of course the strength of that's on the strength of winning at TCU, which is solidly an NCAA team. And by the way, TCU should have beat Kansas the other night and blew it. Also a really close loss at Louisville. Anybody watched Louisville last night? They were up 23 on Duke and blew that. The only way I believe it would happen would be for Lipscomb to win out until the title game and then lose to Liberty in the title game, and then I think you could see both of them in. But still, I mean, if you're MTSU last year, for the most part in these leagues, you just have to think the only way you feel really good about it is to get that auto bid.
I was talking about this last hour, the fact that you know, when we see what LSU is doing, normally when you think of LSU, first thing at the top of the mind is the football program. When we think Tennessee, from a longtime tradition, yeah, great success with the Lady Vols, some moments there with the men's basketball team. But first things first, you think Tennessee football. I think it's great not just for college basketball in the SEC. I think it's great for college basketball across the country when we see programs like this, normally known for other things other than men's basketball, because I don't know if we'll ever get back to where we were in the 70s and early 80s, but I would love to at least see everybody try to get that back as far as the love and appreciation for college basketball, especially on the men's side.
It is fun to see, and you know, when you have a school or fan base like Tennessee, just a really large fan base, and a starved fan base, too, by the way, that just wants to rally around a winner.
And you see,
you know, what can happen.
I mean, it's a football school.
It's always going to be a football school.
Like you said,
the Lady Vols, I mean, that's the most tradition
that they have in any program.
But this men's team is, they're overstuffing Thompson Bowling Arena. And you know, Johnny, that is not an easy place to overstuff.
I mean, to me, that was built about
7,000-8,000 seats too big when it was built in the late 80s.
But now, when it's stuck, it just reminds me, when I was in there last Saturday for that 40 game, I was like,
well, this is basically an orange rup.
I mean, that's exactly what it felt like. So, and that makes it fun
to have
someone like that
in there. And so we can
follow someone other than the
usual suspects, Duke and
Kentucky and Gonzaga and Michigan State, whoever. I mean, it's nice to have some variety. And I think it's also,
when you have a team like this that's very easy to like and a coach who I think is very respected and liked, that makes it even better.
You know, looking at the same side of this coin, I mean, of all years for the Vanderbilt men's team to, you know, having a season from an historic, just like Tennessee's season is historic, but for Vanderbilt, it's historic for all the wrong reasons. When you're having, you know, record-setting performances, a Tennessee team that every night out, each additional win, it adds to their longest winning streak in the history of their program, and then you counter that with what Vanderbilt is struggling through now, 11 straight losses, 0-10 in conference play. And look, all you got to do is just look at three basic stat lines, especially since Vanderbilt got into conference play. Look at the fact that they, in every game except one, they have more turnovers than assists, except for two or three exceptions since they've got into conference play. They usually shoot 62% or worse from the free throw line. And those are the things that each and every night, it's the same scenario. Not finishing the game, they have opportunities with 3 or 4 minutes to go, not finishing strong, and committing too many turnovers and not making your free throws, it never changes. It's like Groundhog's Day, the movie. It seems like the same story over and over and over and over again.
And it is amazing what you pointed out there, the you know, historic streaks going on, and we've seen those two teams play once, and you would have sworn that the one on the historic losing streak was better than the one on the historic winning streak for most of the night. You know? But you're right. It's a lot of the same deficiencies. Some of them just aren't going to get corrected. I mean, it's not going to be a good free throw shooting team because it's got a couple guys who just aren't good. You know, the turnovers, I mean, some of that is focus. Now, there is a pretty wide range of overall performance, I'd say, when you think about, like, the game against Kentucky and Mississippi State, when by the end, I mean, it was just ugly. They were not competitive remotely. And then you think of other games, but, you know, they should have won the game at Arkansas. I mean, I give them credit for fighting and for coming out even amid all this losing and fighting. But then, like you said, the same deficiencies come up and bite you. So I still think somewhere they're going to find themselves a win somewhere along the way. But I don't feel confident in pointing at any game on the schedule and saying that's going to be the one.
Well, I don't see it happening tonight in Gainesville. How about the ironic part of it? Could it happen, you know, I mean, between now and next week? Vanderbilt still has, they got Florida tonight, and then on Saturday they play host to Auburn. What about if it happens next Tuesday in Knoxville?
Well, you know, I've already canceled. I was going to, you know, go cover that game, and I canceled out of that because I don't expect it to be a game. So if so, you'll know why, because the Rexroad Way went way awry.
You know, you may want to rethink that. You know, just something out, you know, something in the waters. I don't know. You might want to rethink that a little bit. I was having some fun earlier with you today because the Baltimore Ravens, and it's not official because officially they can't announce it yet, but Joe Flacco is being traded away from Baltimore to the Denver Broncos. And I had to point out, it's like that moment when you realize your franchise quarterback is not your franchise quarterback. And you know where I was going with, you know, which direction I was going with that. You know, first of all, just hearing that, have you seen enough of Lamar Jackson to think he's the guy?
I mean, I really like how he played down the stretch. And I like his upside. You know, I think sometimes still, you know, the accuracy is a little bit unreliable. I mean, I love some of the conflicts he can put defenses in. I also think to what San Diego did with its defense, you know, to sort of take away what they've been doing to teams, and you think, man, next year those NFL defensive coordinators are going to be a lot more prepared to deal with him. So he's got to take steps for that to be the right move, I think, moving forward. I mean, I don't look at him and this team next year and think, oh, yeah, watch out for the Ravens in the AFC North. But at the same time, I get moving on from Flacco, too. I mean, look, he won you a Super Bowl, so he'll always have that. You'll always have that. But, you know, I mean, I think Flacco is a marginal starter in this league at this point, which makes him perfect for Denver.
Joe, that's funny. Joe Rexroad with the Tennessean joining us. You know, you look at the potential landscape there as far as free agent market, and if you're the Titans and you want to improve your wide receiving core, you know, it's kind of lean. you know, I know that you get the Golden Tate out there and all that. To me, and certainly they have room to do it if they want to pull it off, is Antonio Brown such a bad idea to try to find a way to get him?
I mean, I think it's worth exploring for sure. I mean, I don't see how you could just completely ignore a talent that special. I know he's going to be 31 in July, so, you know, you get to that age, running backs and receivers sometimes can fall off the cliff, so to speak. But I think you've got to look at it. And I know that he does not fit what John Robinson has tried to do. He has tried to avoid people who are disruptive and say weird things and get in fights with teammates. You know, I mean, that's a big part of Brown, especially the last couple of years. I mean, it's been one thing after another. But, you know, it is a deal, I think, when you've worked so hard to build a good locker room, if you think you've done so, then why can't you take on a guy like this and, you know, expect him to, you know, assimilate and be a team guy? I mean, the Patriots, if this is going to be modeled after the Patriots feel great about their locker room, and they sometimes go out and get guys who have had troubles. And, you know, and then they'll let him go on a moment's notice. But they don't seem to worry about always getting the exact right personality. I think if you've built the right, quote-unquote, culture, highly overused term in sports, then you should be able to deal with an Antonio Brown.
I mean, the bottom line is, look, if you look at the Patriots, especially in the 2017 year, and who knows, it probably could have continued behind the scenes and even this past season, but the Patriots have fighting going on inside the building, maybe not physically, but certainly there was infighting going on amongst everybody, and including Tom Brady, a part of that equation. And so when you look at what the Steelers had to deal with once again the drama with Le'Veon Bell as well. You know, the pent-up frustrations probably got the best of everybody there in the month of December.
Yeah, I mean, it's no doubt. I mean, it's hard to avoid any drama, you know. I mean, the Titans do have a guy in Terry Lewan who's liable to say about anything and go taunt an opponent on the sideline after a game and wear a Boss Hog outfit. So, you know, everybody's got something unique, and I think that's fine. Yeah, the Steelers have had a surplus of it. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to, you know, I think Roethlisberger maybe gets more of a pass than he should with some of this stuff based on some of the things I've seen him say and the way he comes off. And so maybe, you know, you get Antonio Brown away from him and maybe he's better.
I mean, I go back to, and we talk about this often, you know, as far as the draft, you know, there's no sure things coming out from a college standpoint. If that was the case, Tom Brady wouldn't be selected in the sixth round, for example. Russell Wilson wouldn't have been chosen in the third round. The list goes on and on and on. And so with that said, if I know there's a known commodity out there, and, you know, to me, I know GMs love to play around with the draft picks. I mean, that's why there was a movie about a GM with Kevin Costner and Draft Day, all about the maneuverings going on, because GMs want the draft picks. But, you know, knowing what we know and more importantly, knowing what we don't know as far as how somebody's college game is going to translate to what they can do in the NFL, show me somebody who year in and year out is having incredible success in the NFL, and I'm going to give them a strong look compared to a draft pick. I mean, yeah. Right now, let me just ask you right now, Corey Davis, if knowing what we saw out of Amari Cooper, what he was able to do with the Cowboys, or Antonio Brown, knowing what he has done in his career with the Steelers, which is more valuable to you, a first-round pick that would have given us Corey Davis, or a known commodity like that?
No, I agree, but you're right. These guys all so value those picks. I mean, look at what John Gruden has done. Because they somehow think they're just going to make all these great picks with them. And history tells us that's probably not likely, that, you know, a Khalil Mack, a potential Hall of Famer, is something you might want to hold on to versus betting on yourself with a bunch of picks. But that is how GMs think, of course. And, you know, I mean, again, in the NFL, it's things just change so fast. I mean, it wasn't long ago the Titans made the deal to get DeMarco Murray. He was the best running back in the NFL. And a little more than a year later, he's out of the league. You know, so that that's part of it. You know, is that when guys get to a certain age, you get really afraid of whether they might fall off. But
here's the thing. If you really pay attention to numbers and analytics, the fall off for DeMarco Murray was dictated if you looked at other top backs that went through similar things with the number of carries that they had in the previous 2 years, 3 years, whatever the case may be. Almost 100% you see the dramatic drop off.
Right. Post 30. And then, you know, of course he had those injuries. I mean, I still think the injury, he was never the same after the, you know, injury he suffered against Jacksonville on Thursday night game, his first year with the Titans in 2016. So there's that, you know, the Antonio Brown right now, I see, you know, arguably the best receiver in the NFL at this point. So, you know, it's some of it also is how close do you think you are? You know, of course, what would he do for your offense? But how close do you think you are? I mean, if it's where you only think it's maybe a couple pieces on defense and maybe you get one huge difference maker on offense, shore up the offensive line, and you feel like you can compete with anyone, then, again, another reason to really think about it.
Well, the biggest part of it for me is the fact that the Colts are have a huge advantage right now where they have, as far as all the room with the salary cap, with what they have as a team. And to me, you better go for it this year because I think that the Colts, if they make the right personnel decisions, they have a great opportunity to pull ahead of everybody in the league again.
Hey, how about the Colts trading for Brown and signing Le'Veon Bell? What would you think about that? He's literally, you know, like 20-0 or whatever. I mean, you know,
that's when if you're fans of the Tennessee Titans, you're hoping that Major League Baseball brings a franchise to the city. that's what you're hoping for at that point if you want to watch winners. And I'm not being facetious. I'm not being facetious when I say that either. So, all right. By the way, I know you from the Michigan area, as you were the Sports Writer of the Year in Michigan as well, besides the back-to-back here in the state of Tennessee. What can the – you know, when I think about outstanding power play, I go back to the Red Wings of the 90s. You know, every year we talk about this. What can the Predators do to improve their power play?
Yeah, the Russian Five, you know. Those guys were pretty good moving the puck around. That was some incredible stuff to watch. Yeah, well, I think that they've done one thing that I think will help it. And we'll see over the term. But, of course, they got one last night. And Subban, you know, with the slap shot. And Brian Boyle shielding Jimmy Howard's eyes. And that's one big reason he's here. You know, he gives them that big body they can throw in front of the net. They need more of that from him. They need more of that from other people, too. They just, you know, again, I think that the power play this year, I think they've just, it's gotten to be this big thing, and they just overthink it way too much, and they try to be perfect way too much, and sometimes it's just get the puck up there, get a rebound, and go get it. And I think that's the best way to deal with it when you're struggling. And too often I still think they're trying to be just so perfect, and then you end up getting like one shot on the power play or no shots. And, you know, last night's 5-on-3, you know, they just had nothing at all really promising in a minute of 5-on-3. But that power play looked good, and I think that's the answer. Is you have to be more physical, and you have to be willing to go in those, as Peter Laviolette says, those tough areas. And I think, you know, there's no reason these guys, the way that a lot the same guys have performed on the power play together the last couple of years, should be this bad.
Do you tinker at all with the lines?
Well, I already did. I mean, he had, you know, Turris on the fourth line last night. He put Bonino up there with Smith and Fiala. I think you probably give that more of a look. I would bet that would be what Laviolette would go with in the next game. And look, you know, I mean, we're what, 12 days from the deadline. And I think you can do some tinkering now, but I think everyone knows there's a real chance that there's something different about this lineup within 2 weeks. And then you've got, you know, about 18 games after that deadline to know what your team is and to really bear down on who works best together and get ready for the playoffs.